Welcome to the first Inside Lane broadcast. We're live from Runners World HQ here in Cape Town. We've got Dr. Ross Tucker, a world-renowned sports scientist who's been quoted all over the world for his work across various sports, not just athletics, as we're going to be talking today and most of next week during the World Championships. But rugby is obviously a big passion of yours, and we've talked about cycling in the past, but your knowledge of sport has been obviously what we're going to be getting Ross involved with over the next couple of weeks. So the intention of Inside Lane is really just to kind of bring you some insight around the World Championships. As we know, South Africa is going to be well represented with the chance of getting probably the most gold medals we've ever got at World Championship level, and we can talk a bit about our chances of that. But we also want to look at a global perspective on athletics, and particularly the World Athletics Championships. We know there's some interesting studies which Ross will explain a bit later on that are happening internationally, and we're going to be able to give you some insight into things as they happen on the course. We're going to preview each day, so every single morning at 10 o'clock you can tune into Runners World on Facebook, and we'll be able to also take your questions. So when you're actually following us, send us some questions on Facebook. Hopefully we can answer them. If I can answer them, I know Ross will almost certainly be able to answer them, and if we can't do that, we'll phone somebody.
We'll make something up.
We'll make something up.
You can correct us, and we'll acknowledge you the day after.
So that's the plan. But let's first of all kick off with the latest controversy, and that's to do with the selection of the South African athletics team, but not just in that capacity, how teams are selected for events like the World Championships.
Yeah.
Just briefly, the controversy around South Africa in particular, my thinking is that the thinking behind it is correct. If this is a World Championship event, you need to take the best athletes, but the execution has been fairly poor on the side of Athletics South Africa.
Yeah, so I think the thing is, selection controversies are not unique to South Africa. Mm. There's an Ethiopian steeplechaser who's just been banned for 2 years because he punched his coach. He was so angry that he didn't get selected because they held trials and he'd finished third in the steeplechase trials and didn't go. So they went against their own selection policies as well. Mm-hmm. Ethiopian woman in the 10,000, they held the trials and 1, 2, and 3, not one of them got selected. They chose three other women who didn't even run in the trial. So it happens. Mm. But the South African one is just, from start to finish, you can question the process. Because what the IAAF does is they set standards specifically because it's a World Championships, and you don't want people running in the same race as Usain Bolt finishing the 100 meters in 13 seconds, and he's just packful. Mm. So they set these minimum entry standards, and the assumption is that if an athlete can achieve those standards, then their national federation picks them. ASA, whether you agree with this or not, have decided to create a different entry criteria, which is usually, but not always, more stringent. Now, I don't know how they come up with it. I know how I would do it, and I'm not sure they've done it the same way. But for instance, the IAAF, to qualify for the 5,000, because this affects one of our athletes, you have to run 15:22 women. Mm-hmm. The Athletic South Africa standard's 15:09. So the problem that's going to create is you're going to get this inevitable clumsy situation where some athletes are bang in the middle.
Yeah.
They've achieved the IAAF standard, so globally they're recognized as being good enough to go, but Athletic South Africa's standard, they're not. And what Athletic South Africa's done, for reasons that still aren't clear or are false, is that they have selected some of those athletes and not others. And so Dominique Scott is one, mm-hmm. who, she's the one I'm speaking about, she's run between the IAAFs and ASA, she's not going. Mm-hmm. Whereas there are other athletes who are. So in total there are 20 of these athletes, and 14 of them are sitting at home. Mm. And the rest have been chosen to go and compete. Now, if you're an athlete, you're looking at this and saying, hell man, like,
yeah,
I did exactly what was required. I'm in the same boat as them, but they're on the plane and I'm watching it on the couch. And
the thinking is potentially correct. I'm very worried to say that, but in that you want to take athletes that you know are going to represent the country well to be in a semi-final, and because we have gold medalists, maybe that standard is higher. But you know, people say, well, is it a financial thing? It's not, because the IAAF pay for the athletes to go, so that's not the issue.
Right.
What other reason would ASA be thinking about not taking these athletes? I mean, is there any real reason that you can work out why the local federation would not take the most amount of athletes?
There might be some indirect cost down the line, because an athlete who goes to World Championships might then be able to motivate for support the year after and the year after that. And so maybe someone's thinking strategically, but I highly doubt it. There seems to be not much of that going on. So the quality thing, that's not unique in the world. Olympic programs live and die by their medal capability. Mm. So Team GB, for instance, after the 2012 Olympics, they cut the funding entirely for some of the sports. So now we're talking whole sports federations. Basketball in Great Britain was deemed to no longer be a medal prospect. They went from £7 million over the next 3 years to zero overnight. Mm-hmm. And so they call that no compromise in sports. So that attitude does exist, but in this instance, there's no need for it because the athletes have hit the targets. They're not going to cost anymore. Mm-hmm. They don't even cost the flight.
No.
So literally for the ink on a piece of paper of naming those athletes, they could have been in London. Mm. And the biggest damage really is that when you select someone who's not a medal hopeful, you know, so you look, we got a 100-meter guy, Enrico Branchi, says not going. He would, if he makes the semis in London, he's done well.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but it's actually not about him. Mm. It's about the 17 or 18-year-old who wants to go to the World Championships in 2025, which would be, okay, maybe 2023, who's looking at Branchi's and saying that these administrators are actually playing fast and loose with the rules. And as an athlete, I live and die by times. Milliseconds and millimeters is what I am about. And when that objective standard is no longer enough, then this sacrifice that I'm making as an athlete suddenly doesn't look like it's worth it anymore. Yeah. And I'm actually going to say, you know what, given a choice between a BCom and a track and field career, the BCom starts to look a bit more viable than the
or basketball starts looking more viable.
Yeah, or something else starts to look more viable. Yeah. So the problem is that the message it sends is wrong. If you select those athletes, you're sending a message that says, we are rewarding you for your hard work and we're giving you a springboard. You know, in 2013, who went to the World Champs and didn't make it out of the heats was Wade Fenikak. By 2015, he's world champion. By 2016, he's Olympic champion, world record holder. So had you applied that policy then, he wouldn't have gone in 2013. Now, he probably still would have made it, but a lot of others maybe don't, you know? So you're denying people the opportunity that they've earned, and you're denying the next generation confidence in the system. So that's the reason it's so controversial.
The hardest thing really is that they literally find out 2 weeks before the championship
that
they're not going, which I find, surely you want to know, you know, maybe 3 or 4 months in advance so you can peak and know if you're in.
Yeah, so now you're just ticking off a list of incompetencies. Yeah. Because, okay, so how do you set your standards? I don't think they set them in an evidence-based, data-driven or credible way. How do you communicate those standards to athletes? Should those standards even exist? And then you get to, now you've made your selection, it's too late.
Yeah.
You don't communicate that until early enough. The appeals process is a disaster. There's arbitrary decision making. Person A goes, person B doesn't. They've done the same thing. So if you're an athlete,
just to move forward with this, I know we can talk about the selection of South African athletes probably ad nauseum here. There's been so much written about it in the media in the last couple of days and some fairly inflammatory headlines we've seen in some of the newspapers. Just got a question from Brian John Records on, I don't know if that's his name, whether it's his recording company, but he was asking, where to from here for the ASA board? In other words, will they be able to turn this around? Do you think they'll look at selection differently? I don't know. It's a difficult answer, but I don't think so.
Part of me wants to say, where to from here? London business class and then home? Like, that's what they'll do. And so now, if you go down that list, the final one is like complete lack of accountability. There's no accountability, so they won't be forced out. The only time I can remember a board or an executive turnover in Athletics South Africa was when they completely mangled the Semenya controversy in 2009. That was the one that eventually forced Chweni out, and there was a bit of an overhaul. They'll just brush this off. We'll go to London as a country, and we'll win. I'd be surprised if we don't win four gold medals.
Yeah,
we've never come back with that many medals, never mind golds. Plus, maybe
let's go through them while we're talking about it. We talked about this yesterday. Four gold medals. Like, hang on a minute. I've only got two. What are the four for you?
So your two are
Caster and Wade.
In the four. Yeah. So I'd add Wade in the two.
So we know that because Bolt's not running the two.
Even if he was.
Even if he was.
Yeah, Wade.
You think that's why he's not running the two?
That's why he's not running.
He's scared of Wade.
I don't even know if Bolt would get a medal in the two.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about Bolt in the week because the men's 100 is on this weekend. So we'll get to Bolt in detail, I reckon. But Bolt, if you think back, 2008, Bolton, that's 9 years to be at the top position. This is a guy in the twilight now, right? So it's not really a fair race. Yeah. He's at his decline and Wade's at the peak. So,
he's not running mid 9 seconds. He's running upper 9 seconds.
No, 9.95. He's never been as slow coming into a major championship spot. Okay. So I think Bolt has taken the. It's not right to call it the path of least resistance, but it's the path of least likelihood of losing.
Okay.
So
you think there's reputational damage for him if he loses in that tournament? It's difficult to say because we're not him, but if you're the greatest ever, do you want to lose in your final world championship?
No, he'll feel there is, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, in 10 years from now, no one's going to look back and say, Bolt, whose career was defined by his defeat in the 2017 World Champs.
Yeah, for sure.
They'll look back and I'll say, Bolt, who still in 10 years holds the world records and won this many gold, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So actually, no. But at the time, you can understand. The guy wants to end his major career as quote unquote undefeated because he had a false start and he's had a teammate disqualified for doping. So there's a couple of defeats there, but.
Yeah. All right, so let's.
So I would say Wade wins the 200. The only thing there is the fatigue aspect because you run three races in the 4, and then you run three races in the 200. So the 200 final will be sixth final or race, and that's demanding.
And the last time somebody did this at a major event was Michael Johnson in '96 in Atlanta, if I remember. I read something about this the other day.
So
it's been very difficult to do that since because of the schedule, whereas they actually changed the schedule this year so that it was possible for Wade to do that, which is a remarkable thing, really.
Which tells you what... So this is another theme that will come out of London is these guys, the people who run athletics, are losing their big draw card after London. Because Bolt will run maybe one or two more races in the Diamond Leagues and then he's done. So who is going to be the next Usain Bolt? Now, Wade Funicak is not Bolt character-wise. He's not pulling the Bolt pose. What does he call it? To the moon or something.
Well, lightning pose.
The lightning, but whatever.
But maybe we need to invent one for him.
And he's not dancing or... I mean, Wade Funicak's the guy who's collapsing in relief after the 400 title and going to his family.
Yes.
Bolt's the guy who's... jumping on a Segway or getting run over, whatever.
Yeah. Or doing a DJing the party that night.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they need a performer to take over from Bolt. And I think you saw it in Rio, like Funicak's their guy. And so they I don't know if I'm loath to say they need him to do the double, but it will help them if he does the double. And I think he will. He's the second fastest in the world over 200, just behind Mukwala. But Mukwala's also doing the 4-2, and I don't think he's going to come through as well. So I think Funicak wins the 200 actually quite comfortably.
Okay,
would be my guess.
All right.
And then the
you're all live with this, so people will be able to look back and.
Oh, that's fine. So that's 3, and then 4 is Manyonga in the long jump.
Oh yeah.
So Manyonga, even if you take out the altitude jumps, because sprint and jumps events are hugely benefited by altitude. So. That's why when you look at our sub 10 second sprinters, most of them come in Pretoria Poch, right? So it helps.
Yeah. And the long distance guards are terrible in it.
They don't even bother racing for time. Manyonga's jumped 860 3 or 4 times this year, including in a couple of Diamond Leagues. And he's 25 centimeters net better than the next guy. So, unless he has a really bad day, his last meeting, I think, was in Stockholm, and he pulled up after the last jump, and he was limping a little bit. Hasn't jumped again, and I must be honest, I haven't seen anything in the news whether he was injured or not. But if that injury is more serious than has been reported or looked, then there are question marks. But if the injury is fine and he has managed his training well, then the guys. I mean, you're 20 centimeters better, you're going to win a medal, and it should be gold. If he doesn't, the next best guy is a South African as well, and it's Samai. So you got to think there's a gold medal in the long jump, whether it's Manyonga or Samai. And then the final potential is Semenya in the 15, which I think that women's 1500 is the most interesting event in London.
It was
one of the top events before she decided to run it, but the addition of Semenya to that group of four athletes makes the race tactically and physiologically and newsworthy.
Yeah,
it's, that's a big deal. So
because the whole race will change for some of those athletes because they know that they're going to get outkicked, which means that they have to change the way that they would run that normally if she wasn't in the race.
Yeah, exactly. So that's going to be, and that race is first. So Semenya does the 15 and then the 8.
Mm.
Which is interesting because if anything's going to compromise her 8, it's the 15.
Yeah.
If they'd been the other way around, it was an easy decision.
And they go through 3 heats for the 1500?
Yeah, at least. So she has to run 6 races in 10 days, which is tough.
Especially at that level. Yeah. I mean, so, it is quite amazing to think that this little country of ours, which, you know, in history since we've been back in the world sport, we haven't really performed exceptionally well. In the 90s, we had good times with the 400 meter hurdlers and Ezekiel Sepping in the 800s and that whole
Mulazi,
we had some really great runners.
Some high jumpers.
Yeah. So it has been good, but to think that we might have 2 double gold medalists, not to put pressure on these guys, but that could happen.
Yeah.
And maybe 5 golds will put us right in the top 10 countries probably in the world.
Yeah.
Based on the medal table.
Yeah, by gold medals for sure.
Yeah. And that's what gold is what counts, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah.
You want to be winning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So 4, I would say 4, well, certain. And then it's never certain.
Mm.
But we've got a couple of athletes there who you would, if you were desperate, you'd mortgage your house on.
Yeah, yeah.
I put them in among the 5 most certain medals in the championships, actually. Vernikkek and Semenya in the 8.
Yeah.
And then Manyonga and Vernikkek in the 2 are very strong possibilities, I think. And then Semenya's maybe a medal in the 15. We'll talk about we'll talk about specific events on the morning of and as we go through the heats. So I don't want to
preempt it
too much now, but
let's just talk on a global scale. How does selection happen for teams? South Africa's, we talked about that. How does it happen globally? How do they choose the best athletes to represent a country?
Well, so the most well-known one's the US, where it's just a shootout over a week, and they have a US trials where as close as possible, they try and replicate the World Championship program, and they say to those athletes, you come top 3 and you go, and if you don't come top 3, then you... Sorry. And that's led in the past to some big, high-profile omissions.
Yeah.
I mean, Michael Johnson failed to qualify 1 year for the US team.
That's right. Remember that. Yeah.
In response to that, actually, the IAAF has now said that they give exemptions to athletes who are current world champs, and Diamond League champions, so that because they obviously they want the best guys. It's not like cycling where they'll disqualify Peter Sagan on the 4th day of the race. You know, they want the guys there.
Yeah.
So the USA, they basically say top 3 you're in as long as you also achieve the qualifier. So there have been cases of people who've come 3rd at the US trials haven't achieved the qualifier, and then it goes to 4th.
So it's a bit of BMT on the day, so they can weed out those athletes that can perform.
And that's how they defend it. They say that if you can't cut it at US trials, then what's going to happen on world stage? So
and they've got a big, they've obviously got a much bigger pool of talent than.
So you can afford to be inefficient when you've got like all those.
Yeah.
So last year, for instance, one of the big favourites in London in 100 hurdles will be Kendra Harrison, who missed the US trials. Well, she didn't miss the trials, she couldn't qualify. Out of the US trials, and then a week or two later she broke the world record. So then we had a situation in Rio where the clear number one wasn't even in the event. She won the US trials this year, so she's fixed whatever. I mean hurdles is fragile, you clip a hurdle, you're as likely to break the world record as come 8th, you know. So so anyway, so that happens. And then other countries, Kenya holds the trials, but they're a little fast and loose with it. They've had controversies also. Men's 800 in the trials, they didn't pick the guy who came 3rd there. They chose instead to pick other guys. So
they're basing it on just selectors making decisions about who they think will perform best, not just on the trials performance.
Right. So it's a combination. Because when you're top 3 in the Kenyan 800, you're a medal.
Yes.
Like you're going to be a medalist. You're competing for gold.
Yeah.
So,
which is why a lot of those athletes have went to Bahrain, because they could guarantee a chance to the world champs and a bit of money.
I mean, Kenya's got guys who finished 6th in their trials who would be middle prospect, even lower.
Different.
So the Kenyan trials are, I suppose, loosely described as a guideline, and then they base it on medal likelihoods. You know, Ethiopia seems to do the same. GB, they have a national championships from which they select as well. So it varies around the world. For us, we have some, they're not unique, but they are challenging issues. Our track season starts in January. And this, by the way, has implications for some of our medal chances, because if you're performing well in the South African season, it means that you're at your relatively peak shape from February onwards. The time you get to August, you are bringing that physiology dry. So that's where I have doubts around Manyonga, you know, to be in an explosive event like long jump, to be jumping 860 from March all the way to August, that's
it's always been a challenge. It's always been a challenge for the Southern Hemisphere countries anyway. Australians have the same structure, you know, because you have to perform. It's a weird thing. You have to perform in front of your local crowd and also make sure that you're competitive globally. And a lot of the top athletes don't bother about the South African season once they get to a certain level. I mean, I'm sure Wade van Niekerk wasn't peaking for the South African season.
Yeah, so they have the luxury because they can do well in South Africa running at 85%.
Yeah.
And a second and a half off his best. Mm. He's still dominant on our scene. So so he's happy, Semenya's happy. Okay, Manyonga would be, but he hasn't been jumping at 85. He's been jumping short of world record, but still, right up there.
So. Yeah. Just talk generally about the World Championships. Obviously, the big story is going to be Bolt's and his last sort of hurrah and the last swan song for him. Going to be a lot of hype around that. What other stories? We've talked about Wade van Niekerk. We've talked about Caster potentially doing a double gold.
Yeah.
What else is kind of brewing there? Is it about performance? I believe there's a big study going on there during the World Championships as well.
Yeah, so there's a few good scientific things that will come out of London, and that's the focus of this podcast. Is like we don't just want to talk about what happened in the men's 800 and why the guy got boxed in with 200 to go. And we will, but I want to also touch on the science. And so, for instance, there's a big biomechanics study. They've done these at every World Champs for the last, I don't know, since 1987, I think. But this year is going to be the biggest one yet, and they're going to study, I think it's 17 events, and they've got these high-speed cameras plus camcorders around the track at various points, and they're going to give us, for instance, in the sprints, ground contact times, stride length, stride frequencies, 10-meter splits and so forth. In the distance running, they'll give us foot strike angles and so forth over the course of the men's
Why 10. Should we care about this? I mean, it's great, but... What is it? I mean,
it's literally what I do, right? So like, I love it. But like, why? Okay, so why should a guy who's going to run park run on Saturday care?
Well,
so let's pick one. Is the foot strike angle thing. In the last 10 years, there's been a lot of conversation around, should you forefoot strike? Is heel striking dangerous? The whole barefoot running thing fed into that because... Part of the motivation to run barefoot is that you should change from a heel strike to a forefoot strike. The research we did in Cape Town with Nick Tam, who's now got his PhD on this, showed that only half of people did that anyway. But anyway, this is an aside.
Only half went on the forefoot.
Yeah, we took a bunch of guys who used to running in these, and we said, take them off and run. And
this is our shoe wall, by the way, if anybody wants to know what this is.
We keep all our shoes.
We have a shoe a day, anyway.
Yeah. So we say, okay, take the shoe off and let's stick with the biomechanics. And only half the people make the shift. And even after 8 weeks of training, like not many more people have made that shift to forefoot.
Yes.
So the whole how do you land and does how do you land impact injury risk, and so that matters. And so
can you change the way you land?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's that.
How do you go about doing that? So that's the broad context for it. But the reason it'll be interesting with the elites is because there's this perception perpetuated by the discussions around barefoot running and forefoot and so on, that the elites land forefoot and the park runner lands heel strike. And I think we'll find that might not be true.
Okay.
Although running in track spikes is a bit more difficult than heel strike.
One of the things we're going to do this week is we're going to bring in our gear to Ryan Scott and to talk a little bit about the technology of shoes, because he deals a lot with the shoe. We can discuss how track shoes are so different in terms of the way they operate. And really
what makes a good sprint spike? That stiffness, you know. Yeah. So that'll be... And then we can spin that off to like the London track is fast.
Okay.
For the same reason that a track spike is fast, because it's stiff and hard.
All right, explain what a good fast track is. What is the... If it's fast, what does it mean? It's slightly downhill? Yeah. How do I make a track fast?
You make it harder. Like, okay. you make it a golf ball instead of a squash ball.
Uh-huh.
You can imagine, if I'm going to pelt you from 10 yards with a ball, you'd rather have a squash ball than a golf ball.
Yes.
Because when you strike on a hard surface, a hard compacted surface, there's less energy lost on that impact. Yeah. And sprinting especially is all about losing energy on impact. That's
okay.
You know, so a sprinter wants to be in contact with the ground for as short as possible, but they want to generate as much force as possible.
Mm.
And energy dissipation, which is to say losing energy,
mm-hmm.
is very costly to sprinters.
So the actual surface, the tartan,
So
is it different? I mean, a tartan is actually just very small pieces of plastic, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of
plastic. Like, it's a rubbery type.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not an engineer, I'm going to butcher this one. But
the
principle is make it hard, make it compressed. And they've done that now at major championships since probably Atlanta.
Mm.
And the distance runners, Gebre Selassie used to complain because he said that these tracks are made for world records in the 100, 200, 400.
Mm.
And then we got to run 25 laps on this in spikes and we're going to hurt ourselves. And he used
so the actual impact injury of a guy running a 10,000 meters actually is an effect for those guys.
Yeah, and if you've ever run for a while and fatigued yourself and then you shift to concrete compared to even tarmac and then grass, you can notice the difference on what it does to joints. And so that was his argument. I don't remember other guys complaining, but he had that.
So would you expect to see some world records?
No.
What's the most, if there is one, where would we see it?
Woman's hammer throw.
Anything more interesting?
In the interest of disclosure, between the two of us, we know very little about, especially the throwing events. Like high jump and long jump, maybe a little, but we're gonna
read up about it.
We'll have to. But there's Vlodarczyk is the woman who broke the world record in Rio in the hammer, and just a week ago was 11 centimeters short of it.
Okay.
And so she's most likely to get that world record.
So we're gonna watch out for the woman's hammer throw.
We are gonna set our clocks to
watch. Is she Belarusian?
I think she's Polish.
Yeah. Are they Polish or Belarusian?
Yeah, the men's guys are also Polish. It's obviously their national sport. Men's 400 went in Rio. That was Wade.
Yeah.
People
could
say
it
could go
again. Yeah.
I haven't seen anything in the build up to the World Champs to suggest that he can go that fast.
So here's a question for you. There's been a lot of talk over the years of athletics that I've covered where guys like Wade, who are so dominant in a particular event, they don't go for world records at World Championships or Olympic Games because there's no money incentive. So if you know you're going to win, you hold back over the last 10 meters so that you can do it at the Weltklasse or one of those events that they have in Europe where you can get paid big incentives. Is that a fair summation of professional running? If Wade van Niekerk's looking around, he's got 5 meters on his nearest competitor and he's literally with a chance of getting the break with record. I would do that. I would say, right, I've won this. I don't need to break the world record. I'd rather do that at the Weltklasse where I'm going to earn some money.
Probably, but I don't know if he's thinking in that moment,
yeah.
I could get the world record, but I'm going to not do it. I think he's thinking I'm winning.
Yeah.
And that's what I need to
do. We've seen Bolt do that in the 100 when he was winning and he's kind of.
Yeah, but Bolt wasn't thinking about his bank balance in that moment. He was just thinking, wow, look at me.
Yeah.
My shoelace is undone.
Yeah.
I'm going to celebrate 10 meters from the line. Like, because he was just. So I think things are the same. I think the athlete gets into the blocks and says, right, I'm going to go as fast as possible today. And like, I'm going to go for, maybe Wade's thinking, I'm going to go for the world record.
Mm.
But in the worlds of the Olympics, I think he's thinking, I'm going to win.
Okay. Yeah.
And so maybe that slight difference of, but I agree with you that if Wade's going to do it, he needs to be, with 70 meters to go, he needs someone there.
Mm.
You know, he had that in London.
Mm.
Plus, he was scared. He was running scared because he was in lane 8 and he didn't know where they were until the last 100 meters. So I think that actually helped him.
Mm.
People made a lot of the fact that this unique world record from lane 8, but that's, I don't think.
He's basically running, in theory, he's running a time trial against himself in that situation.
Yeah, yeah. So the self control.
Which they say is, but then there's less of a bend.
Well, yes.
Is that a factor? I mean, he's going less of a corner.
It's certainly a negative factor for you in one.
Yeah.
But I think from lane 8, the biggest issue is that you have no ability to gauge where you are.
Yeah.
So the mental self-control to manage an effort over 400 from 8, that's impressive.
Yeah.
But then again, maybe there was no control. Maybe that's just like Wade going, like, run for your life. Like, And then he got to 100 meters to go, and he was like, okay, there's a couple people there. So now it's like, this is the Olympics, this is my shot, I'm just going to go for it. And the result's the world record. I don't see it happening in London. No one's going to be close enough, first of all.
It's a pity because that, I mean, anybody that watched that Rio final in that last 20 or 30 meters, watching him stride away from the rest of them, and everybody else was tying up and fatiguing, he seemed to accelerate. And it really
wasn't.
He wasn't in scientific
When we talk about the sprint events, the 400, even up to the 8, the pacing stuff for me is really interesting. And I've got Wade's splits, and you see how he got slower and slower and slower in that race. But everyone else, Merritt and James, just absolutely imploded.
Which happens in the 400.
Everyone slows down.
So the last 100 is the slowest?
Yes.
Almost every time? Nobody ever does a negative split?
Nobody. No, unless you jog the first 200. No. But then you're running a bad race.
Yes.
So
okay.
If you're running an authentic 400, you're slowing down.
Okay.
And Wade, off historic 200 meters, because no one had ever gotten to 200 that quickly. Even his 2-3 was quick. He slowed down less. You know. So that was. So it looked spectacular, but it was really. It would be, like my nerd, the sports science nerd in me thinks one day we'll have little digital speedometers on top of each guy's head. You know, showing you. Like they had at the tour, we had like live GPS.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be cool. Because then you'd have seen like Merritt, these guys were slowing down 30, 29, 28, and he's holding 31, 30. Yeah. So that would have been the difference. So, but no, I don't think a world record. Women's steeplechase, that's a hell of a race.
Last year. And that's a fairly recent event. It's only been going for sort of 10 years.
Yeah, and it was lame for a while. Like, no offense to the steeplechase, but it was weak.
Yeah.
Because it was new. And I think it took a while to attract a better caliber athlete.
Yeah.
But then last year you had Jebet, who's a Kenyan running for Bahrain, and she was just every race like going for world records. And this year she's not even top three. And so within
I must admit, there's something inside me that when I see the Kenyans running for Bahrain, that kind of I don't know.
Whether it's Qatar,
I understand why they're doing it because there is good money involved.
Yeah, and that's an issue that'll come up. The IAAF haven't got that right because you've got there must be half a dozen Ethiopians running for the Netherlands or Sweden or whatever for Turkey. There's Kenyans running in Bahrain, Qatar, Turkey. It's a mess. I mean, there are some running in the USA who are naturalized because they've been there for 20 years, and that I've got no issue with that.
Yeah,
but these ones, I mean, some of these people they don't even live in the country. They haven't even been there for 3 weeks a year.
Yeah.
They just go there to collect their, I don't know, paycheck and passport, and off they go back to Kenya. So
suppose we are in a world of professionalism. It's the same thing with soccer teams and rugby teams and cycling teams. The UAE cycling team isn't made up of people from the UAE. It's made up of people like Louis Mankies and Ben Swift on the team.
Sure, but then we should get rid of world champs and we should just call it the Premier League or something. And there's already a Diamond League for that. So I would like them to have like a 5-year residency rule. Or something a little bit stricter, or exclusion from major championships for 8 years or something.
Can they hold a conversation on Bahrainian?
Yeah, like the citizenship test, but like they do in the US and England, that'll be a story. I mean, that's always a story of European champs. Because the European championships, especially the distance events, are absolutely overrun by Moroccan, Ethiopian, and Kenyan athletes.
Running for Holland
and Spain and whatever. Yeah. And then the Europeans are saying, but like, come on, I'm the best European, but I'm coming fifth.
Yeah.
Like, that's a bit
farcical. Yeah.
So that'll be perhaps a story.
Yeah.
And then the other big one, and I hate to be the like bringer of doom and skepticism, but
this is the D1.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, you cannot, and this is to journalists who are watching this, you cannot authentically write about track and field athletics without acknowledging doping. You can't do it.
Explain that.
Well,
I don't like to almost think about it because maybe there's an ignorance about that. It takes away, if you think that it's happening, and you're doing cycling, you can't think everybody's suspicious. You know,
I guarantee you, like, if we had more, okay, I don't know how many questions and comments we're getting, but
no, people are going to see them at the moment.
People are going to be saying, oh, leave our heroes alone. I got this on Twitter the other day. I posted some comment on the weekend about a story that we'll go into because it's got implications for doping. And people say, leave the heroes alone. And I get that people want heroes, right? But when in 2001, if you'd brought up the possibility that Armstrong was doping like David Walsh did, people were going to say to him, leave him alone, he's an inspiration. Well, fine, but he's also doping. Like, and then yeah. David knew that at the time, and now we all do.
Mm.
And if you, not David's not the only guy who knew.
No, for sure.
So on the weekend, the Daily Mail, because we're back in London, you know, it's going to be the fifth anniversary of the London Olympic Games. In London 2012, there was a Super Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the 4th of August 2012, or the 5th, I forget. Mo Farah, Jess Ennis, and Greg Rutherford on the Saturday night in London won gold medals.
Mm.
And that was now, because they were the hosts, this was the big, this is Super Saturday. And they're they've decided to reincarnate, as it were, Super Saturday now this weekend. Mm. And those London 2012 games were hailed by various people, Sebastian Coe being one of them, as the cleanest games ever. Mm. Well, on Sunday, the Daily Mail looked, I mean, it's not a complicated analysis. They said, what percentage of the track and field athletes from 2012 either failed the test there or have since failed the test? And it's 1 in 7. So 13% of those athletes at the cleanest games ever, thanks Seb, failed drugs tests in the intervening 4 or 5 years. Now, a lot of those were Russians, because we know what happened with the Russian athletics or sport afterwards.
Are the Russians in the world champs?
They still require an official exemption. So
there's no Russian athletes at the world champs?
Competing under a blank flag, there are. But not under the Russian flag. So in the women's high jump, the overwhelming favourite is Maria, formerly Kuchina, now Lasitskaya. I think I've probably butchered that, sorry. But she's competing as a Russian, but under a blank, placing the white flag.
Okay.
So there are some. And she could become the first gold medalist under that flag, I think.
Okay.
I think no one won it in Rio. Anyway, point is, so you're looking at 1 in 7. There are studies on prevalence where they've gone to athletes at world champs and they said, do you or have you ever doped anonymously? So they're basically asking you, the athlete, have you ever taken illegal drugs?
Mm.
And even though it's anonymous, you know that some people aren't going to confess. So whatever number you get is an underestimate, and you still get 30-40% confessions. So you're looking at 50% of the athletes are doping. Now, that doesn't mean, I just want to be clear on this, because I know people are going to leave our heroes alone and something. It doesn't mean that every single athlete's doping.
Yeah.
But if you can't at least acknowledge that. So for instance, I've studied and with some colleagues, we've written a dozen papers on why Kenyans are the best runners.
Mm.
So I have a vested interest in Kenyans having some genetic advantage, because it's my stated position.
Yeah.
But we cannot have a conversation about Kenyans winning medals without acknowledging that Kenyan anti-doping is an oxymoron.
Mm.
It doesn't exist.
Mm.
Ethiopia, it doesn't exist.
Mm.
So those guys are disappearing into these rural areas and they are inaccessible to doping testers, anti-doping testers. So when you see a clean sweep of Kenyans at the marathon, say over of all the medals in the marathon, you can't say what a glorious day for Kenya, blah, 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 and not mention, however, there is this elephant in the room. It has to be there. And there are some athletes that I think are more glaringly obvious than others. But I mean, I'm fine saying it. But like, if Mo Farah wins a gold medal on Friday night, it's the first gold. It's the first track gold, certainly. With everything that's going on with his coach Salazar and his other coach Jama Aden, who's under investigation in Spain. Salazar's under investigation in the USA. Farah disappears to Ethiopia for many years. It was leaked the other day that his blood passport was likely doping a couple of years ago. You can't celebrate Mo Farah's 56th medal or whatever it is and not say, but serious questions remain around Mo Farah's credibility as a clean athlete because of very strong association with dope coaches, very strong evidence of dishonesty around his association. You have to tell that story.
Yeah,
so it's not possible to. You're delusional.
I guess it's a bit like the Lancers. You know, you do watch. You, I mean, I was one of those people who during the Lance Armstrong years would think, well, until somebody is proven guilty, it's very hard to assume that they are.
And
I guess when you're watching an event like the World Championships, it is magnificent watching Kenyan athletes running the 3,000 meter steeplechase, admiring their skill and ability and their incredible athleticism. It's a hard thing as an athletics lover to accept what you're saying. I'll be honest with you.
Look,
even though I know it's real.
My earliest memory, which I'm sure subconsciously somehow inspired me to study sports science, was it's not my earliest memory. I'd be, someone thinks something wrong with me if my best memory was when I was 11. But I was 11 years old, and I remember watching South Africa's readmission in 1992 to the Barcelona Olympics.
Yeah.
And I remember two races in particular. The one obvious one was Ilana Meyer against Tulu in the 10.
Mm-hmm.
So that stood with me. And then the other one was the men's 10, where Chilima lost to Khalid Scar in an extremely controversial. There were disqualifications and reinstatements and appeals and whatnot. And then ever since that, when I was 15, waking up at like 3 in the morning and watching the men's distance, I loved watching the East African runners. But you can't.
Yeah.
You can't pretend like there's not a problem there, you know?
Yeah.
And one of the issues is, and I know that over 10 days we will have to talk about doping again.
Mm.
One of the problems is people say we need proof.
Mm.
Anti-doping is completely incapable of providing the proof that people need. Because what people need is a positive test. Mm. But again, I said earlier, 40% of athletes confess to doping.
Mm.
At the time of the event, only 1-2% fail tests.
Yeah.
So you've got 40 out of 100 doping and 1 out of 100 failing, which means 39 in 100 get away with it. The testing is...
But they also have the potential of not getting away with it at the end of the day. And you can't control everybody, but you want to try and make it as
difficult
as possible.
Yeah, you want to disincentivize it, right?
Yeah.
But we know now that the hope that you would take an athlete's blood or get their urine sample in London at the World Champs and put it under, I was going to say put it under a microscope, it's a bit more complicated than that.
Mm.
Put it through some lab tests and up pops a testosterone or EPO, hopelessly naive, because that's not how doping is done, right?
No.
So the standard of proof that anti-doping was designed to find is unrealistically high.
Mm.
We were basically asking for a video of a guy committing a crime with a smoking gun in his hand. That's what we were looking for.
Yeah.
Now, in the criminal justice system, sound like a Law and Order ad, that's not the level of proof that's needed.
Yeah.
Because they do detective work and they will pull together, where were you? They'll ask for alibis, they'll look for associations, they'll find indirect proof, they'll follow the money.
Yeah.
That's where anti-doping needs to go to find proof. And in my opinion, sitting here, there is enough proof around certain athletes that if this were a court of law and I was a juror or a judge, I'd find you guilty.
Yeah.
That's how it is. So.
Russ, I know we're running out of time, but we've got some interesting week ahead of us.
Do we have any questions?
I haven't been able to access the questions at the moment. We are running a bit out of time, so what we'll do is on Friday we'll make sure that we get to as many questions as possible. Don't forget, every single day from Friday, we're even going to do it on the weekend. That's how much we love this thing. We're going to be doing it Saturdays and Sundays. We're going to be doing a live podcast. We didn't know how long it's going to be. It depends on what the stories are. If you want to follow Ross, he's on scienceofsport.com. A fascinating website. I'm trying to see.
The website's sportsscientists.com.
But the Twitter handle is
scienceofsport.
Science of Sport is the Twitter handle. And what is the website address again?
sportsscientists.com.
So sportsscientists.com.
Two S's in the middle.
So it gives you a fantastic, and I tell you, I'm warning you, don't go onto the site if it's during the day of work, because you'll read a story and then you read another story and you read another story. I find it fascinating. So if you want to have a look at some real insights, Ross has got that. We look forward to hosting you from Friday for the entire duration of the World Championships, giving as much insight as we can. Please, once we get our systems up and running, we'll be able to answer some of the questions that you posted today. Please interact with us. Let us know what you think. Let us know about what you'd like to talk about, and we'll be able to hopefully provide all the answers. Ross, thank you very much. We'll see you on Friday
for
a whole 10 days of athletics and all the drama that goes with it.
Cannot wait. Thanks.
Cheers for now.